podcasts to help you reach your positive potential. HRNradio.com.
Yes, welcome, Dr. Bernie Siegel, and welcome everyone else. We're very happy to have you on Mind Health Matters, and we're on quite often. We enjoy it. I hope you do, too. And in case you have not had an opportunity to go on Dr. Bernie's website, you can do that by going to, Dr. Bernie Siegel, no, it's BernieSiegelMD.com.
Right.
BernieSiegelMD.com. Welcome, Bernie. We're not supposed to ask the question, how are you doing? So I'll ask, did you get enough snow yesterday?
Yeah, plenty. Yeah, you're supposed to say either you look great today or you sound wonderful. Don't say, how are you?
Okay, so you sound wonderful, and I'll find out later how well you look when I see you. Yeah, so now, Bernie, you said you've got two books that you're working on.
Yeah, one will probably be out beginning at the end of this year.
Mm-hmm.
It's with Hay House.
Wonderful.
And it's called, I think, No Endings, Only Beginnings, I think is the title they're going to give it.
Wow.
And we're working on, well, I've written the book. But let me just say what's interesting. I've mentioned it before. My wife died a year ago, January.
Yes.
And I was going through papers and some things in our bedroom. And I found things, literally, from 20, 30 years ago, which I think I was putting together for a book. I don't know. But I love finding those papers and reading them, you know, because it was as if someone else had written them, material from other people. Just things that meant a lot to me. So,
yeah.
And one of them, as a matter of fact, included a letter from a minister in Texas saying, your book, Love, Medicine, Miracles, is like the Bible. There are so many quotes, you know, so many statements that are the same.
And
believe me, that is nothing I had in mind when I wrote that, because I don't have that kind of depth of knowledge of the Bible, to say that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I found another letter from Science of Mind, that group, saying, I use your comments as quotes in my sermons on Sunday. And
yeah.
I thought, wow. So I started putting all this together. I called the minister in Texas. She had the same phone number as she did 30 years ago. So I called her, and yep, she answered, and we talked. But it was sort of an inspiration to me. So I put together all kinds of experiences. And what I mean by No Endings, Only Beginnings, that was a title people put on it. I was going to call it Bible 2 or A Manual for Life. It's all that everybody's been writing, you know, back to Jesus and before him. And
yeah.
We're all telling each other how to live.
Exactly.
So I just try to update it and make it modern so people reading it today will understand what we've been saying for centuries about getting through life. But I really felt that we do need a guidebook or a manual. People are writing them all the time, I have to say. All the things, I'm turning my head looking around. I mean, I got piles of books that other people have written about their story. About life, with different titles, but
right.
It's always what everybody went through in their lifetime and now what they've learned about it. But we need a basic, source of information that people can look at it and say, oh, okay, yeah, thank you, and help them get through whatever they're going through. And I may add, I'm not the only one. I forgot who the author was who... said that we should have a Bible too. Maybe I can find it in my computer and things if I can open it. But it's all the things that people, as I said, have been saying, and it's fun to find the same thing all over again. When you're saying to people, why do we call it Bible too? And they think, oh, that's kind of crazy, and what will people think if we do that? But then I come across a quote from somebody, here's Ralph Waldo Emerson. We each should have our own Bible, too.
Oh.
Our own collection of sayings that are important to us that help us. Ralph Waldo Emerson. Because my first, these are some notes in my, you know, computer stuff. Bible 2, Mind, Body, Spirit, and Immortality, a guidebook for life. And other people at Hay House have come up with, what was it? Did I say no beginnings?
No endings,
only beginnings. Yeah.
Right.
And that's, you know, it's like the recycling that we go through. Because our consciousness never ends. That's a different part of us. So we are immortal, not in a body sense, but in our spiritual mind, unconscious, whatever words you want to use. In that sense, we are immortal. You know, the body is something we use like a tool, and when it gets worn out and tired, or you know, is killed in an accident, our consciousness still is around and can, you know, recycle, find a new body, hop in and move on.
Exactly, exactly. Well, you know, you've always been involved. I mean, all your books and everything is, have started with the concept that a patient said to you, how do I live between office visits? And that's how you began.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's not something, when you get to medical school, they don't say, all right, you're going to teach people how to live. You know, what they teach them is, all right, this is how you're going to, you know, treat a disease. This is what you'll give a person, what pill you'll give them. Because at my medical school, Cornell, it's improving, I have to say that. but they just sent out a notice that they have a whole bunch of doctors come in of all kinds of specialties and let the students go and talk to them on one day. And, you know, I said, hey, why don't we come in and talk to the students about the people, you know, because it's not just do I want to be a surgeon, a cardiologist, you know, and talking to them. I mean, yeah, that can help. But, you know, in terms of what you're choosing, I mean, for instance, I chose surgery for conscious and unconscious reasons. Consciously, I was an artist. I liked using my hands. So, you know, I wanted to continue to do that. And surgery seemed to be a wonderful way of doing it and helping people and fixing things and so forth and so on. But, see, the emotional part is that, oh, good, I'll be a surgeon. But then you can't fix everything.
Right.
Some people die because of your surgery with a complication. And, oh, brother.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Nobody prepared me for that. And I said to the medical school, why don't you let me come in and talk about that?
Right.
They were interested, but it didn't fit into that day. So I don't know whether I'll hear from them again. You know, but I think that's something the students don't hear. And I don't know if I've mentioned this to you. What kind of doctors do you think have the highest suicide rate? I mean, I have to say that the suicide rate for doctors is higher than the general population. But what specialty do you think is the highest?
Oh, I think I know. Anesthesiologist.
Right.
Yes, right.
I may have mentioned it to you.
Uh-huh.
Because when I, you know, read that in some article, I thought, oh, boy. You know, think back a minute and say, why do you want to be an anesthesiologist? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you said, well, I want to be a doctor, I want to help people, what you're doing is putting them to sleep. You know, you could say, yeah, but then they don't have any pain.
Right.
Yeah, but what kind of relationship do you have with the person?
Exactly.
You know, like the one who said, I need to know how to live between office visits.
Right.
I said, all right, I'll put you to sleep, you know, so you won't have to worry in between.
Yeah.
And I think, again, it's depleting the doctor to be in that situation. You're not getting anything to nurture you.
Well, you know, Bernie, you're onto something because doctors today, not doctors and medical professionals, they're all suffering from burnout and fatigue and, you know, caregiver, you know, whatever problems they end up having. But they're not taking care of themselves in one way or another, probably emotionally. Or I think they need help. I think they need support. And I think what you're talking about would be very, very valuable, not just for the doctor alone, but for the whole hospital and the patients.
Right. I call it living the sermon.
Uh-huh.
You know, that we need to talk to each other, help each other. And be coaches for each other.
Absolutely.
I always thought it was criticism when the nurses talked to me about what I was doing, you know. And I would say, what's wrong with me? You know, you're always telling me that I'm not doing it in the best way or the right. And they said, well, we know you listen, so we talk to you.
Right.
That never occurred to me, you know. Because everybody's always telling you. You know, it's like, let's say you're on a team and the coach keeps coming over and saying, no, don't bounce that way. Don't stand that way. Look, come over here. Put it in. And you think, Jesus, I must be the worst guy on the team. But then
exactly.
The coach says, well, you're one of the few ones who listen to me.
Right.
So I talk to you. And that's what I learned. You don't hear any criticism if you never listen or pay attention. They give up.
Yeah,
but
that's true.
When people know you care and listen, then they keep talking to you, and they're not telling you, as a lot of kids have heard and others, you're a failure, you embarrassed me. You know, that's not coaching. That's putting the person down. That hurts.
Right.
But
right.
When people tell you there's a better way of doing something, and, you know, I can't help but, again, I don't know what stories you've heard from me, but my wife was having surgery for a small breast cancer years ago. And the anesthesiologist wanted to be sure that I was not nervous or worried. I mean, he was an old friend of mine. You know, he had done anesthesia for me. Not me personally, but my patient. And so I knew he was trying to look very proper and well-trained. He walks into my wife. He looks up and says, you're quite a handsome fellow. And suddenly, he's a different man.
Exactly.
He sits down. He and my wife start chatting. And I'm looking at, they're on a date now.
I mean, well, they're getting along.
I just stood there. I didn't know what to do. The time was going on, and all they were doing was talking. And I finally interrupted. I said, excuse me. You know, they look at me. What is it? We're here to have surgery. Not a date. And then they went, oh, you're right. And then we all walked over.
Well, it's called creating rapport, you know.
She is so great at that. And
yeah, but that's what you did in your whole medical profession.
Well,
you talk to the person. You
make
to know
them. Person.
Yeah.
And it's some small things. When I say again that my wife could, we're in a restaurant, she would say to the waiter, "You have a lovely smile," or "You have a cute outfit on," or and they become a person, you know. And we're not just another customer; we're that nice customer that you know that. Complimented me or said something.
Well, you know, I love it when people compliment other people. It makes them so human. It brings people together. There's a common connection. It changes the world. It really does.
That's why I can't remember what stories I've told you already on all these programs because my mind, you know, I'm not in charge of what I say. My angel used to say, I'm the television set. But
right.
Now I'm trying to remember. Oh yeah. Into one of our local stores, you know, it's a market food, so forth. And the clerk who sits there says, "How are you today?" And I start my routine. Don't ask me how I am. I've got all kinds of problems. I don't want to be remembering them. You know, if I come in, say something like, "You're looking well today," or, and at that moment, out of the back comes an employee who I've known for years. She and I are old friends. And she walks in, looks at me, and says, "You're looking very well today." And the whole store bursts out laughing.
That's great.
And I said, "See, I've trained her." But I also realized I felt better hearing from someone, "You're looking good today," versus "How are you?" You know? So,
well,
I mean, you can help charge people's battery when you give them a... You know, like a hug.
Absolutely.
Even if it's verbal.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Give them a little hug.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you know about Leo Biscaglia when he was around years ago?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He was a hugger. I mean, he taught love, but he was such a hugger. People used to line up after his talks and get a hug from him.
Yeah, what was the title of his book?
Bus 9 to Paradise. He had a few of them. He wrote a few books.
Something with love in it, I think.
Love, yeah. I'll see if
but
I can
anyway,
find.
Yeah, I love all the things he was writing. The, you know, we were in that these days. We started doing this back in the 1970s and 80s.
Yeah.
So we
yeah.
all became friends because
yep.
we were all seen as rather strange.
Yeah, well,
is he the one who wrote Love is Letting Go of Fear?
No, that was Jampolsky, Gerald Jampolsky.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, yeah. He was fantastic, too.
Yeah. But, yeah. you know, we were all learning
yeah.
And then writing about it. And that's why, as we started this, I'm still writing, you know, like Bible 2.
Yeah, yeah.
And the immortality aspect really is about that consciousness. And that you hear more from spiritual
yeah, true.
People. I'm true. Reading again. From Ernest Holmes, Science of Mind.
Yeah,
and I just noticed it was written in the 1930s, which I didn't realize.
Imagine.
Yeah. But yeah. I have read it more than once, but each time you read it, more comes out of it. Because as I mature and grow and become wiser, I'm more in touch with what he's saying.
Uh-huh, you know? Uh-huh. Well, it takes maturity.
Yeah,
it does.
You talk about immortality, too, and everything mm-hmm. else. Mm-hmm. And then I've written a novel. Originally, it was called The Insurance Man because that was what one of the people. But now it's three men and six lives. Now, what does that mean? It's about past lives. So these three men have had six lives. And it's true. I mean, it has happened. I made up characters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what happens to the insurance man happened to me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't want to put myself in. I thought that would just distract people. So
right.
these three characters who all come together, because one of them is a psychiatrist. So as the other two seek help from him, he happens to have a past life experience and is so impressed by it, he works it with them. And then all the things that they learn about their past, who they are today, and everything else.
So is this your second book, the other book that you're talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And as I said, I made the title Three Men, Six Lives. I thought that ought to make people pay attention.
Yeah, well, I think that it's important to bring things into focus for people, you know, whether they believe in it or not.
Right.
There's, like you say, even if you wanted to consider it fiction, that doesn't mean you can't learn valuable lessons from these things.
Yeah, I think in the introduction, say it's a nonfiction novel. And I said, what do I mean by that? You know, oxymoron is what's nonfiction are the stories. What's fiction are the people.
Right.
So it has the truth. By using other people, so you don't make public the people that it happened.
Well, absolutely. As you've said many times before, that fiction actually produces
right.
a lot of truth. They talk yeah. about truth. You learn about truth.
Yeah, the authors
yeah.
are writing the truth while making up a story
right.
about it. And whether
right.
it's a poem or a novel, you know, it's the same thing.
You know, Bernie, when you talked about a Bible, too, and you were talking about this other book that you've written that Hay House is going to publish, what comes to my mind about, let's say, spiritual truths, whether you want to call them religious, well, you can call them religious, and at the same time, spirituality has been defined as both religious and non-religious. It's,
right.
it's still spirituality. But, I mean, you know, most of us growing up have entered into the domain or through the domain of the religious. But so many people today are becoming spiritual, and certainly with your help, of course. But here's what I'm coming to, that these things that people said years ago about your writing, you are writing spiritual concepts, the spiritual truths. But the point is that spirituality is truthful. It has a sharp point to it. And so you can end up having religion, science, physics, all reaching this summit of the sharp pointedness where all truths meet. You know, they're not separate. They're all
right.
one. It's just that you're identifying it from your perspective.
That's what I said. I love Ernest Holmes.
I do, too.
Writing way back, you know, all these decades.
I do, too.
Because he's saying that and clarifying it.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of what immortality may mean to him and the nature of our lives and so
yeah.
forth.
Yeah. He said, if you can only learn to love, you'd be the most powerful and happiest person in the universe.
Right.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, in the world. and it, you know, so I find that as a resource, and I find that rereading it is good because as I mature and become wiser, I get more out of what he is saying.
Yeah. Same
and
words
the
on the page.
Is yeah. That, I mean, religion can be a problem. Look at the fights in the world today. What are we fighting wars over?
Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
My religion, your religion. I mean, it's absurd.
Right.
You know, when you leave your body, in a sense, you don't have a religion anymore. You're a spirit, yourself. You're part of it all. But that's the sad part, and why we have to stop using beliefs as a way of separating ourselves. You know, you're a dumbbell. You have the wrong God. You don't understand.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I agree with you. We've talked about beliefs many times, and I agree that beliefs could be very limiting for us. Yeah, but somehow or other, we have to create new beliefs that empower us as well as others. If we could create those kinds of beliefs, then we would certainly create a better world.
That's why I'm writing these books.
Perfect.
Because the novel, the people at Hay House said, we don't publish novels. I said, as I'm rereading it, it's, you know, I won't call it Bible 2, but I said, it's so spiritual.
Right.
You know, because I find quotes from Jesus and others in my novel. And it's, again, bringing all that together with these characters.
Absolutely.
So I'm surprised when I reread it to edit it. You know, it's like, hey, this is good. I didn't know I had that in there.
Perfect. You know, well, let's hold up on that thought of together, because we'll be right back, and we will be together again. Just stay tuned, and we will be right back.
Give yourself some love with our self-care programs at hrnradio.com.
We are back.
New topic.
Yeah, new topic. So go ahead, introduce what you
were. We've been away. We were told we'd have a break for 3 minutes.
Ah, yes.
And the number three we'll get into, but, you know, I think about it in many ways, because numbers have meaning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like 7 days in a week, and eight becomes a new beginning in many ways. But on our TV set, what number do you have come up before you pick other channels?
Oh, well, 12, and I understand you could change
no,
that.
No, you go to 12, but what I see on my set on the front, when the TV is on without a channel, number 3 is there. And then you can go ahead and use, you know, the TV.
Uh-huh.
Whatever that 3 represents, it's
I
there on my set.
Right.
And the number, you know, the Trinity, Father, Son, Holy Ghost, whatever. But I think that mind, body, spirit, but the number carries something and means something to people. Even if they're not aware of it, it still has meaning. And you know, and for people to keep aware, I'm always saying, whether it's colors or numbers or, you know, unconsciously, all these things have impact on us.
Mm-hmm.
So whether it's a red light means stop, or the number 3 has a spiritual meaning to it, you know, to pay attention to all these things, because they're a part of us and have an influence on us.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, well, one of the ways, I mean, just one more sentence,
sure,
that we store our personal experiences is through numbers. So you'll see this in dreams, drawings, just a certain number, and people often don't realize why they're stuck on a certain number.
Mm-hmm.
But when you say, what happened to you at that age, you know,
right.
You know, or, well, or like, I remember my wife talking to a lady who had done a drawing with a path with something like 35 bricks in it. And my wife said, you know, why 35? And the woman's eyes is like, oh, you know, they popped out. It's related to a certain date in her life and or a certain age. I don't remember exactly. But, you know, it stunned her. That, and think about sitting there making 35 bricks. You know, taking the time to do it and then stopping at that moment. And so we learned to count everything.
Wow.
And, you know,
and it has meaning.
It could be how many kids you have, mm-hmm. when something happened, but
right.
it predicted oftentimes It predicted when people were going to die.
Wow.
And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean when people were ready, you know, they were tired and ready, and they would draw a picture with a certain number, and you knew that was the date and when it was going to happen. I mean, one little girl, I got a, because I have her picture hanging in my house, I told the mother to stop taking her all around the world trying to, you know, cure her cancer. I said, it's not going to be, and what are you doing to your daughter? You know, spend time with her, loving her. And the daughter drew a picture, and I said, look, you know, she's ready. There was a purple balloon going up with her name in it. And I said, that's a spiritual color. She's ready. And then there were other things in it that confused me at first, because there was a face of a child with yellow and green, nice, healthy colors. And I said to her, what is this? That's the kid in the next room crying. And I thought, wow, here's a child who intuitively knows when you're drawing the kid in the next room, you change the crayons and the colors. But then there was a certain number of things around the balloon, little colorful dots all around, decoration. And I said, I don't know what that means to her mother. So she took her home from the house, just to take her home to be happy, you know, to stop treating the disease.
Right.
And she called me a couple of weeks later, said, Bernie, today is my birthday. And Amber woke up this morning and said, Mom, I'm dying today as a gift to you to free you from all the trouble.
Wow.
And when we counted those little decorations, those were the days between when she did the drawing.
That's
the
amazing.
Day she died.
Yeah.
I have that still hanging on the wall. And I may add, Mother Patty has done so many inspiring things for other kids with cancer because of Amber. You know, she's put together all kinds of things. And I have a picture of Amber that I use as my bookmark.
Now, Bernie, when you're talking about these things, and I have a profound understanding of drawings and reading them and the insights that you could draw from them, and over the years you've used it to diagnose illness, understand patients,
right.
and we're talking about the, not negative, but the... we're talking about illness and how to understand illness, and that we have within us the power, let's say, to predict certain things. We seem to have that power. You're able to read that. You're able to pick it up.
Yeah, so, we're not predicting. We're knowing.
No, it's already being written, but it's written in another language that's artistic. So you could read that, you know, just like you were reading in a book. But here's my thinking on what we're talking about. If this is true, which it is true, that we're very good at orchestrating our future, let's say, because we have some control over it, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
You've proven that. Okay, so here's my thought. My thought is, and again, going back to, a science of mind and these, wonderful authors, Ernest Holmes, then that means that we have the ability to create powerful, positive things in our life. We don't seem to tap into that in order to realize that not only can we do beautiful, wonderful, powerful, healthy things for ourselves, but for others at the same time, because it's a power that we don't tap into. But you're exploring this power. Right now you're looking at it as making a diagnosis, understanding illness. But imagine if we used it, I call it, to the good. What if we had such power, which I think we all do, and we used it to the benefit of all of us?
Right. You know, we're all a part of God. I mean, that word can cause trouble for people, but we're part of the mind, you know, our mind and the universal mind, whatever you want to call it. And all the resources and wisdom and abilities are in us, too.
Yes.
But you see, if you're whining, oh, look what happened to me. Oh, God damn it.
Right.
But if you've been brought up, again, by the proper coaches, you don't react that way.
Right.
You say, okay, what can I learn from this? And if I have faith, what will it do?
Mm-hmm.
You see, because I see this happen.
I know.
People altering their lives by leaving their troubles to God.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And, you know, there are times your car breaks down or you have something terrible happen. Well, like the hurricane, you say, where's God? Mm-hmm. But what God would say is, what can you learn from this?
Mm-hmm.
How can it redirect you?
Right.
What blessing might come to you because of it? Then you take a different look at life, and your body gets a
true.
Different message.
True.
You know, then, I'm sick and tired of this. Yeah, okay,
yeah, exactly.
I'll get you out of here. You know, we'll die quickly. But when you're experiencing joy, your body knows you want to do the best I can to keep.
Absolutely. So we're going to take a break. Stay tuned for more Joy with Bernie. We'll be right back.
Radio your way. HealthyLife.net.
Okay, we are back with Dr. Bernie Siegel. Bernie, I just want to mention something. In the last segment, we were talking about, well, you brought up universal mind. So for me, that connection, that made a connection for me in the point of the word three or the number three. For example, you and I are two, you know, one and one is two. And for me, the connection we're having, the conversation we're having, there's a third component to this, and I call that universal mind, and that's everyone and everything. And
yeah.
So we're tapping into that. I mean, you certainly are, and that's what, you know,
yeah,
people have found in you.
Yeah, part of that. It is, and people have to realize and accept it, you know, instead of getting back into religion and making up all kinds of rules and regulations.
Yeah,
you know, about what it is and what you're doing and are you a sinner?
My religion is bigger and better than your religion. I mean, does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've been called satanic and occult by a minister because of my beliefs. It had nothing to do with my religion, but what I believe made me like a devil, you know? And he literally was telling everybody not to attend any events that I did. Because I'm satanic and occult.
Yeah, and you were doing meditation.
Yeah.
You were leading people to meditation.
Yeah, well, Satan could take over your images. I mean, like, you know,
well, how
to me
long
it
ago,
was like,
Bernie,
don't
how
you know who's creating your images?
Yeah.
I mean,
how long ago was that, would you say, roughly?
I'd say probably 40 years, 30
years. All right, so you know a lot's changed. We've come out of the dark ages a little bit, and I think that's part of the times that we were in back then.
Yeah.
And it was a great influence from, you know, maybe religious authorities that you shouldn't let, you know, anything influence
you. Well, I still see it today.
Sure.
That some, you know, ministers are telling people God is punishing them.
Right.
You know, not that. That's why I mentioned the books I was writing. I mean, one quote from Jesus, it is done unto you as you believe.
Yeah.
So you have to look at your belief and how you were brought up and you know, where all the authority figures fit into your life. And I forgot. I had another quote in my mind that popped out.
Well, while you're thinking of it, that's the reason I say that we have to develop new, more powerful and better beliefs for ourselves. Because, the beliefs we hold is the reality we experience.
Yeah. This is why I loved his, the other one, was Maimonides. I found two things he had written. And these are, I put in my novel, you see. But he said, if people, and this is like 1,000 years ago, if people took as good care of themselves as they do their animals, they would suffer fewer illnesses.
Yeah.
And the other was that, you know, disease is not a punishment. Disease is a loss of health. Mm. We need to help people find their health again.
Very good.
See? So that it isn't about saying, oh, what did you do wrong? Why did God do this to you? It's no. You lost your health. Let's get you straightened out again, and let's find it, and let's help you to heal. And, and I see that today when people are told they have, you know, a month to live. You know, we're not going to pay for that because you're going to, I mean, it's an insurance company. We're not paying for that because you're going to be dead in a short while. The people who give up hope do. They go home, get into bed, and die.
Yeah.
In a week or two. But the ones who find a new path, you know, before they die, many of them don't die of that disease. Mm-hmm. Suddenly they find out, oh, it's gone. And the doctors are just beginning to wake up to this because, you know, years ago, you have a spontaneous remission. Well, you're lucky. If somebody doesn't die when they're supposed to, always ask them, how come you didn't die? Mm-hmm. And they'll tell you a story, which you could then tell other patients, you see, so that they imitate the survivor. But that was never a part of our training. If somebody didn't die when they were supposed to, it was good luck. You know,
it
wasn't that they did anything. And that's the part I say with novels and fiction. The poets and the authors don't say it was good luck. They write wonderful stories about what the person did and point out that's why they didn't die. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And it is. It's so much the love and I think some of our pets who were supposed to die. And I just did, well, imagine your kids. I called them from the vet to say that Oscar was dying of melanoma, and the vet said, look, you're here, let me put him to sleep. I have never seen a dog this sick recover. That's a quote from our veterinarian. I said, whoa, I can't go home and tell the kids, you know, that Oscar's dead. I got to call them and talk to them first. So I called the house, and our kids got on the phone. I said, the vet thinks you should put Oscar to sleep. And one of our kids said, you don't put your patients to sleep. You're not putting Oscar to sleep. Mm. So I said to the vet, I'm sorry. I got to take him home. And I took him home. And I treated him as if he were my patient. I spent so much time loving him, even having meals with him, sitting on the floor, sharing meals. And we had other pets and dogs in the house and everything. But I would just spend time with him whenever I was home, loving him, massaging him, feeding him. Mm-hmm. And literally, within 2 weeks, I noticed he wasn't lying on the floor anymore. He's walking around the house.
Wow.
I thought, why don't you let him out then? So I let him out with the other dogs, and he lived for 3 years. No sign of recurrent cancer. And it literally blew the vet's mind.
Wow.
Because he would say to me, I never saw a dog this sick recover. But I really felt it was all the love that he got.
Amazing.
That changed him and his body and his chemistry. For all I know, you know, we had three dogs at that time, Ike, Oscar, and Nicky. Ike was their father. And maybe he felt there's nothing special about me. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I'm the middle one. And that if he was depressed, that he was more likely to develop cancer. And then suddenly he gets all this love and just turns everything around.
See, now that you did because the kids didn't want you to put the dog to sleep. But that's what I'm talking about when I say, well, what if we developed a belief system that says it's possible that
that's
the dog will live? Then now we increase the odds even more. All around the world we'll have people that can break through things that we never thought could be overcome.
That's why I've been running support groups since, I think, 1978.
Yeah.
That's about 40 years of meeting with people. And you say, you know, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I learned the potential. So I will run the group.
That's it.
People who show up are special.
Mm.
So I can be their coach, tell them what other people have done, you know, give them guidelines. And that can be from medications, herbs, you know, psychology.
Sure. Right.
I mean, it's incorporating everything, you know, mind, body, spirit kind of thing. So you don't reject anything that can help you, but you make it all part of your healing process.
I got another one for you, Bernie. You know what you may not have...
Well,
yeah, go ahead.
Come
I'm
back.
Sorry.
What I'm thinking is that somebody drew a picture of the devil giving them poison as their treatment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you are.
You think about that, how the hell are you going to recover if that's what you're doing?
Absolutely, absolutely. That's very interesting. Well, when we come back, I got another one for you that you may or may not have thought of that you were doing for your patients. So I'll let you and everyone else know once we come back. How's that?
Environmentally sound for your mind. HRNradio.com.
Okay, we're back with Dr. Bernie Siegel on Mind Health Matters. And Bernie, we were talking about different things that you've provided people in healing with ECAP and the work you've done over the years. There's another aspect to what you've been doing that I think is, you know, should be mentioned. And what I want to label it is the Bernie effect. The Bernie effect, it may not be proven scientifically, but you have an effect on people. You have a great positive effect. And that comes from inside you that's emanating this energy of great possibility. And I think it aligns with the hope that is inherent in many people. They are looking for something to hope for. And they're putting their trust in you. And in actuality, they believe in you. And so they can be healed by the very fact of what I would call the Bernie effect.
Yeah. I forgot the poetess who said, "Hope is a thing with feathers, it perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all." Maybe Emily Dickinson. But, you know, hope is a real thing. Matter of fact, a doctor friend of mine up in Maine started, our group is called ECAP, Exceptional Cancer Patients. Mm-hmm. He started HOPE Group, Healing of Persons Exceptional. And the group is named HOPE. And you see, this is where it means something. Mm. There was a chemotherapy protocol entitled EPO. The first drug was etoposide. I don't remember what the second, all the others were, but it was the first letter of the four drugs, and some of the doctor put it together and called it EPO. One of the people in the study, one of the doctors, said to himself, if I turn it around, it spells hope.
Right.
So he started calling it hope with all his patients. He was giving them hope, not EPO. And when the statistics were put together, more of his patients recovered from cancer than the other doctors. Now, you'd say, what difference does it? Yeah. And now all the books that we're talking about and people we're interviewing, what's his name? Kim Pelletier, a physician.
Yeah.
His book out, Change Your Life, Change Your Gene. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's Change Your Genes, Change Your Life.
Yeah, it was. It was
I don't remember which the title was because it's so up and back. And that's what we have to realize. Our thoughts, our life, all the things we do are not separated from our internal, results and changes.
Exactly.
So when you're looking forward to life and living a healthy life, your genes, the good ones get turned on and the bad ones get turned off.
Mm-hmm.
I always say it's like light switches. You have to do something.
Right.
Identical twins don't get the same disease the same week of their life. And it relates again to how they're living, what kind of life they're living, as to who may get sick and who may not. Their potential could be the same, but who affects the potential and what affects it? And that's why your joy in living. As a matter of fact, the thing I think that is the healthiest state you can be in is when you don't know what time it is, meaning that you do something and are amazed. It's 3 hours later and you thought it was half an hour.
Yeah.
You're in that trance state. Your body knows you're loving life. Because, again, the only time there is no time is when you leave your body. So when you leave your body, there is no time. And I know that because that line is in the show Carousel. When an angel says, there's no time up here, when he says to the guy, you want to go see your daughter graduate school? And the fellow says, he's a baby. And she was when he died.
Right.
And the angel says, there's no time up here.
Mm.
Now, I can tell you, when I heard that in the show Carousel, I knew it's true. Other doctors were telling me, when I would say, those stories are crazy where people talk about their dead relatives coming back. And I'd say, they must be a bum then if they're just hanging around. Why aren't they in a new body? And this doctor friend of mine would always say, Bernie, there's no time up here. Mm. It's not 7 years later that they come back.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't believe, what do you mean there's no time? But then when I heard it in that play, there's no time up here, I said, okay, I can buy that now. Because if, Rodgers and Hammerstein put it in a play, it's got to be true. They're not some doctor trying to tell me stuff.
Yeah, so we have time, so everything doesn't happen at once, and we can't figure out which side is what.
Yeah. But yeah. You, what I have noticed in my own life is you can't have pain, you can't worry when you're doing something creative and have no sense of time. It's an amazing state to get into, and I say to people, if you have something that makes you lose track of time,
Well,
I mean, you could be playing with a grandchild or, you know, fixing your garden.
Sure.
It doesn't matter. But if it's something creative and you feel that way,
right,
it's good for you.
Well, you're in the moment. You're in now. And, you know, there was a book written a number of years ago, Flow, by, you know, Mikhail Csikszentmihalyi, and he talked about that, that once you enter that flow, you're in a timeless state. You're, you know, everything is perfect.
Yeah, when I was helping others, by that I mean in the operating room, you know, operating on people, I never had any aches or pains or
amazing
sense of time because I was doing something for someone.
Exactly.
And it was a gift to me.
Exactly. You know, I think that's the important thing in life. When you're doing stuff, you know, when you're reaching out beyond yourself, that's where you're really connected, and that's where maybe the universal mind comes in, and that's where maybe the number three comes in. You know, you're connecting to everything.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'd say just keep your mind open to possibility, and don't fear failure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's a failure is to not try, you know, to give it a shot.
Absolutely.
And that's why when people would come into our support groups, yeah, I could tell them you'll do better than your doctor expects. You know, and I knew it would happen because of what they were like.
Wow.
You know, they showed up.
Yeah, that's great.
They inspire everybody in the room.
That is great. Well, I can't believe that we're at the end of the hour, but it's been a lovely, incredible hour with you, Bernie. Thank you so much for everything you've done. And for all who have listened, I hope you've gotten as much out of this as I have.